I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Welcome to another edition of The American Idea. My name is John Moser. I'm chair of the Department of History and Political Science at Ashland University. It's about the time of Memorial Day, and we have a guest who has a subject of interest that is very much relevant to that. His name is Eric Abbey. He is president and CEO of an organization called Project Recover. And he's got a fascinating biography. He was raised by a single mother who died unexpectedly when he was only 13 years old. He lived with an aunt and uncle for the next 4 years until he ran away to join the Marine Corps. He attended flight school, graduated as a naval flight officer. He flew for some years an F-A-18 Hornet, was deployed multiple times to Iraq, once to East Asia. Later on, he became an air officer for the 1st Marine Special Operations Battalion, which was deployed to Afghanistan. He retired from the Marine Corps in 2014 with the rank of major, completed a PhD in leadership studies at the University of San Diego in 2019. Derek Abbey, thank you for being with us today.
It's a pleasure to join you today, John. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, could you tell us about Project Recover? What does it do? Why does it do what it does? How did it come into existence?
Yeah, so Project Recover is a nonprofit organization with a mission of searching for, ultimately locating and repatriating American service members that are still missing in action from our previous wars to provide answer and closure to these families that have given the most. The organization has been around in some capacity for more than three decades now, started as just a small group of people that would do missions, if you will, to the Palau Islands in the South Pacific, all funded and one mission a year. And then over time started finding success. We were initially called the Bent Prop Project. But as we grew, we changed our name in 2018 to Project Recover. But along with the change in the name, we scaled our mission. So now we are a worldwide entity. We've been to 23 different countries, located members, all our service members all over the world, and repatriated them and continue to expand our mission. But yeah, our sole purpose is to locate those that have given the most in the sacrifice of our nation that are still missing and provide some sort of answers to those families that have waited too long.
And were you involved, Derek, with the organization from the start, or did you join later on?
I've been involved for about 20 years. So I was a part of the grassroots part of the organization, and I've seen it grow significantly. I've been in this role for 5 years, but yeah, started as a member. Used to go on missions, then grew, became a team member, became a board member as we grew the nonprofit, and then 5 years ago took over as president and CEO.
What was the significance of Bent Prop?
Well, the name of it, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't involved in creating the name, but we use lost aircraft to help find service members. It's a lot easier to find an aircraft that has been missing for, you know, eight decades than it is to find maybe a burial site, although we do look for prisoners of war that have been executed and others lost in different ways. But it was a lot of these missing aircraft that were helping us to locate these service members. And so every time we'd find one of these World War II era aircraft, there would be bent propellers associated with the crash site. And so everybody at some point will go by and touch that propeller. And, you know, it's what was driving that aircraft through the air before ultimately they were lost. And so the name became the Bent Prop Project initially, and then turned into Project Recover later on.
So the organization initially was concerned with the area around Palau.
Yeah.
Why there? What's the significance of that location?
Well, we ended up there by chance. So our founder, Dr. Pat Scannon, was on a separate mission, actually working with a group that was searching for a Japanese trawler that had been sunk by at the time, Ensign George Herbert Walker Bush during World War II. So that team went out to the Palau Islands to search for this trawler. They found it very quickly, and Pat had some time on the backside of that. So he and his wife hired a guide, and instead of doing what most people do when they visit the Palau Islands, which is scuba dive in some of those beautiful locations in the world, they asked the guide to take them to some World War II sites. And the guide took them to a wing in very, very shallow water, and Pat recognized it as a B-24 wing and asked the questions, you know, what happened to the aircraft and what happened to the crew? And the guy didn't have the answers. And at the time, Pat didn't know a lot about the fighting that took place in and around Palau, but started investigating it and realized that there were hundreds of losses in and around these islands that were related to World War II. And most people don't know a lot about the fighting that took place in Palau. Most people, when you mention Palau, just don't even know what it is.
I consider myself pretty well-versed in World War II history. I even teach a course on it. And I have only the vaguest familiarity of what happened around Palau. Could you tell us about when in the war it was happening and give us the setup for that?
Yeah, 1944, 1945 was when most of the fighting that took place in and around those islands. And, you know, most people, when they hear the name that they do recognize, if they recognize anything, is Peleliu. And Peleliu is an island in Palau, and it was a site of an amphibious landing conducted by the Marines and Army in September 1944. Mm-hmm. And so heavy fighting took place there. But what most people don't know about Palau is that there were 9 major air campaigns that took place overhead that, to include, once they took the island of Peleliu, just keeping the majority of the Japanese military in place and blocking off shipping lanes. So they landed on the small island in the south called Peleliu, where there was about 11,000 Japanese soldiers. But the majority of the military was located on a larger island called Babeldaap to the north. And so after that, they didn't advance any further into the Palau Islands. They just kept them in place by blocking the shipping lanes using mostly aviation assets. But a lot of the bombing campaigns also prepared for that amphibious landing, but also, again, keeping those Japanese in place. A lot of it had to do with MacArthur's return to the Philippines and protecting that flank of potential influence on the attack or the return to the Philippines. But yeah, there's a lot of fighting that took place in and around Palau, a lot of losses, a lot that are still missing. But, you know, history-wise, it's not one of those big pivot points that most people look at when they're reviewing World War II history specifically. But, you know, the men that fought and died on those islands and flying over those islands did so just as gallantly as anybody else that fought during World War II. And so we put forth our efforts to provide answers and locate them and hopefully bring them home ultimately.
I am reminded that Peleliu is covered in E.B. Sledge's classic book, With the Old Breed.
Yes.
Perhaps the best first-person account of the war in the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah, we've had the honor of meeting many, many World War II veterans in the past, as well as spending time on Peleliu with some of those veterans, R.B. Bergen being another one who was there with Sledge and also wrote a book before he passed. We were able to spend some time with him in 2014 on Peleliu and one of the neighboring islands, Nagisibis, as well.
So the organization has been around for, as you say, close to 30 years. How many MIAs has the organization managed to recover?
Well, the good thing is that number continues to grow in a positive way. So we have located and documented sites around the world associated with about 300 missing Americans. Of that 300, 70 have been declared buried at sea by the United States Navy. They'll rest where they lay in accordance with Navy tradition. They know where they are. The assumption is that they will not be disturbed, so they'll stay there. 17 have been repatriated back to their families, and about 25 now are going through the identification process, and the remainder still need to be recovered. But we continue to grow on that number pretty much every day we're working on this mission. So it continues to grow in a positive way, and we continue to scale our work in a positive way. You know, as I mentioned, when we first started doing this work, it was all self-funded. We would do one mission a year to the nation of Palau. We'd pay for it ourselves. Mm-hmm. And now we're conducting multiple missions a year all over the world. And our intention is to continue to scale our work because time is not our friend. Erosion is taking place from time on these sites. And of course, human development as they encroach on these sites, depending on where they're at, we might learn if somebody finds a site, but we might not as well. So we're working to expand our mission as much as possible to provide answers to these families. And most people, you know, aren't aware of how many service members are still missing in action. There's more than 81,000 Americans that are still MIA. And when you break that number down, 72,000 of them are from World War II, more than 7,000 from Korea. And now, because the great work that's happening in and around Vietnam, less than 1,600 from that conflict, and then a smattering of others from Cold War era, as well as Desert Storm. Most of our work is related to World War II just because of the sheer numbers, but we have done work in Vietnam as well as Kuwait and other places around the world.
So what are some of the more remote spots where you have found MIAs?
Well, I think Palau is probably one of the most remote spots, sure. You know, but they all tend to be in pretty austere conditions because, you know, the places where a lot of people go are those sites have already been located. But Palau is just one of those special places that hasn't been touched too much since World War II. And so, you know, you can still get deep into the jungle where very, very few people have been dive some of these sites. Not the popular dive sites, you know, the dive sites that we find ourselves on are pretty murky, ugly spots. Nobody really goes there on vacation to dive these spots. But yeah, Palau is probably the most remote or austere location that we've been working in.
So just by chance, Palau came up in something that I've been reading on the subject of Amelia Earhart. And talking about, obviously not a service member, but somebody whose plane went missing in the Pacific. Has your organization had anything at all to do with that or even tangentially touched on it in any way?
Tangentially, we have. An interesting thing is, after World War II ended, there were some efforts to search for Amelia Earhart in and around Palau without success. But we've been interviewed about, you know, the search efforts that have been have taken place in and around her loss, but we haven't put forth any resources ourselves to search for her. We provide, you know, we primarily search for service members, but of course, when people do reach out, if we can provide any assistance or guidance or, you know, sharing of our protocols, of course we do that. And the most recent news related to her loss, I guess in January, a story was released, and they were using the same technology that we use in our underwater searches to document a site that they think may be associated with her. More investigation needs to take place. It's a very, very deep site, but they were using automated underwater vehicles and side-scan sonar technology to map the ocean floor, which is the exact same thing that we do, as well as some additional technologies. And then when we find points of interest, we'll investigate those points using scuba diving or remote operated vehicles, something like that, to get a visual of the site to determine if it's man-made, is it an aircraft? If it's an aircraft, is it the aircraft we're looking for associated with MIAs? And same thing that they're doing with Amelia Earhart searches right now. They just have a lot more space to cover. It is a very, very small needle in a, you know, 1,000 haystacks, if you will, stacked on top of each other. So
yeah, and I think that's what's so fascinating about what your organization does. Could you, without getting too much into the weeds in terms of technology, I wonder if you could walk us through the process. Somebody has reported something in an area of the world. Yeah. What does the process look like?
Well, I'll start with we are one of the only fully vertical non-government organizations conducting this effort. And when I say fully vertical, I mean we do proactive research, search missions, documentation of sites, and recovery efforts in both the underwater environment and the terrestrial environment. The only thing that we don't do is the official identification, which is done blindly by the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency in one of their labs, typically in Nebraska or Hawaii. But so how a mission starts, typically is in the basement of an archive somewhere, is what I like to say. Historians like yourself, we have a full-time historian, Dr. Colin Colburn, who is constantly doing research on these cases of the missing and adding them to our database. And right now we have a database with about 700 cases associated with more than 3,000 missing Americans. And so other information to build on those cases comes from all sorts of different means, whether it's a family reaching out to us or we find ourselves in the field and we interview hunters or fishermen that know these areas. Less and less, you know, we're talking to firsthand accounts, whether they're elders or veterans that fought in these conflicts. But now we're getting secondhand accounts and things like that. But we're always building a case with all sorts of different information so that we can narrow down a search area, whether it's on land or in the water. And once we have enough information, we'll start putting resources towards those and we'll execute a search in a place like Palau. And it could be in the jungle or it could be in the water. In the jungle, it's very basic. We grid out a search pattern and, you know, the technology is boots on the ground and eyeballs in your head with a machete and an old school compass. And sometimes, you know, we're in spots where GPS technology isn't even assisting us, although we're exploring how to utilize more technology in the terrestrial environment as we move forward. But underwater, we'll use automated underwater vehicles to grid out another search area, and it'll just mow the lawn, if you will, a pattern like that back and forth. And it'll come back with side scan sonar imagery of the ocean floor. And then we'll review that information, as I mentioned, kind of looking for points of interest that might be man-made, potentially aircraft. And for the most part, it doesn't look like an aircraft that you would expect. It's often a crumpled mess on the ocean floor. It received a lot of damage from the crash or from being shot down. So it could look just like a coral head. And so we'll investigate those sites. And then once we find a site, we'll document it with the intention of preparing for a recovery mission. And so then once the recovery happens, or once we prepare for a recovery, we launch a recovery mission and we'll send all the people and equipment to that. And it's an archaeological process. We'll grid out the site. We'll have an archaeologist on hand as well as other experts. And we'll just start working grid by grid to recover all the debris from that area. We'll screen it through quarter inch mist, looking for any potential remains, osseous material, as well as artifacts that can potentially impact or assist with the identification. And those are things that, you know, watches, dog tags, but also if it's a multi-crew aircraft, it could be things like life-saving gear that can give us an idea of who this person is. We'll collect that information. And of course, working with the host nations, we'll report that to the host nation as well as the Defense POW MIA counting agency. And then they'll work through a process of officially recovering those remains, typically through the State Department and the Department of Defense. They'll have an appointed person that'll come. But once we recover any potential remains and as well as those artifacts, there's a chain of custody established to ensure that everything is controlled back in and the identification process is not compromised.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So one of the first steps is you see a formation and you determine whether it's man-made. If to our eyes, it looks like a clump of coral. Mm-hmm. How do you make the determination as to whether something is man-made from a very long distance, right?
Yeah. Well, so depending on the depth of it, if it's underwater, using side scan sonar, you know, we'll pull out points. And the important thing is you don't want a false negative, right? So if there's any question, we'll go investigate it to make sure that it's natural or something else. And it takes a trained eye to figure out these spots. And we've been doing this for a long time. It's never fun. So, and you just have to look at hours and hours of side scan sonar. Now we are working with AI and other technology, machine learning, to assess side scan sonar imagery, to hopefully pull out those points of interest, so we don't have to spend hours upon hours upon hours reviewing it. Still a lot of work to do on that, but yeah, we'll still, if there's any question, we'll either send a diver down, or depending on the depth, we'll send a vehicle down, a remote operated vehicle, to put a camera on it and determine, yes, that's something man-made, is it an aircraft, or no, it's a piece of coral or a piece of trash or something like that.
Some of this search sounds like it could be dangerous, right? These Pacific islands and jungles and really deep dives. Have there been any close calls that?
Well, we pride ourselves on safety, that's for sure. So it is, it's an inherently dangerous mission. You're finding yourself in these austere locations, but the underwater work and the jungle work we do do our best to mitigate any risk to the team, and so we have a safety plan in place. We don't mess around with it. We even walk through any potential incidents that might occur. So where is the nearest medical facility if we need one? If we're diving under, or if we're doing an underwater mission and we're diving, where is the nearest chamber? Do we have the appropriate medical personnel on hand? Every single team that goes to the field has a medical representative, whether that's a physician or an EMT of some sort or anything in between. If we're working on the water, we want somebody that's familiar with, potential dive-related injuries that could occur. But we do pride ourselves on safety, but you can't eliminate all of those risks. But we do our very best, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, given your record as a Marine pilot, you've encountered your share of danger in your life, I suppose.
Yeah. Nobody's shooting at me this time, so that. And we'll try and keep it that way, that's for sure.
But poisonous snakes and crocodiles and...
There's all sorts of critters that can mm-hmm. cause some harm, as well as plants and other things. But, the biggest risk is probably just, us tripping on something and breaking a leg or something like that. But
Like I said,
we do our very best to mitigate those things.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how you personally became involved in this organization.
Yeah. So more than 20 years ago, I was in a Marine fighter squadron at the time of VMFA 121. And I had just come back from a deployment to the Middle East from Iraq. OIF-1 had just started, and I had...
Could you explain some of these acronyms?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for staying on top of that. Yeah. I was in Marine Fighter Squadron. 121 was the squadron, and then it was Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. Had just my first deployment to Operation Iraqi Freedom, or OIF, had just completed, and I had come home, and I was in San Diego in the ready room, and the phone rang one day, and there was a World War II veteran on the other end. I was the historical officer for the squadron, so the duty officer just gave me the phone, and on the other end was a gentleman named George Burianic, and he was looking for contact information related to World War II veterans from our squadron, and we didn't have any of that information, so I just asked him, what do you want this information for? And he said, well, we're having a reunion. We get together at least once a year as a World War II cadre, and this year we're getting together in Indiana, and I'm trying to get as many people as possible. And I said, well, I don't have any information related to those cadre, but can I come to the reunion? And he said, absolutely. So me and a buddy took an F-18 out to Indiana, and we met with the old squadron, and they said, tell us all about Iraq and F-18s. And we said, who cares about Iraq and F-18s? Tell us about World War II and Corsairs. And they said, who cares about World War II and Corsairs? But it was just a meeting across time, kindred spirits, Marines connecting. And it was while I was there that they said, you need to meet this man, Pat Skin, and he's doing this work in the South Pacific and islands of Palau. And he comes to these reunions every year and gives us an update and interviews gentlemen. And so I said, well, I have to leave. Unfortunately, I missed Pat by like 20 minutes because I had to get back somewhere on the West Coast for something. I can't recall what it was. But what I did was I said, well, why don't you have your reunion next year in San Diego? We'll have the old squadron and the new squadron. You can come into the spaces. You can see the jets. And they love that. And so they all came out to San Diego. And that was the year I met Pat. And him and I became fast friends, and he invited me to be in the organization. And to me, it was just the right thing to do. And I wasn't sure how I would assist. I just knew if I had the time and the capability, it was worth my time and energy and expertise, if you will, to lend my efforts. And so it took me a while to go on my very, very first mission because I was deploying quite a bit at the time. But I came back from another Iraq deployment. I unpacked my sea bag and packed my suitcase and joined the team in Palau. And we were searching the jungles and the waters of Palau that year. And actually, that was my first mission, was my first MIA discovery. And it was actually a member of my squadron from 121 that I first located. And so at that point, you know, I was hooked and just grew in the organization from there. Again, became a team leader, became a board member, and then ultimately became president and CEO many years later.
Well, fascinating work, and I'm sure extremely rewarding. Is there some way that our listeners that might have a special interest in this could get involved as well?
Yes. You know, you can always go to our website and learn all sorts about the work. There's a full-length documentary called To What Remains out there that people can find on their streaming platforms online and things like that. But we want to hear from the public. We are a nonprofit organization, so we rely on the charity and the generosity of the public to support this mission. But we also want to hear from families. If you have an MIA in your family, you can contact us and share any information related to that person. And if we have any information, we'll share that as well. But we'll add any information that these families have to our database and then hopefully continue to build on those cases. And you never know, it could ultimately turn into locating a site and hopefully bringing them home. And then lastly, we are a volunteer-based organization. So if people have expertise that they think can advance this mission, there's a process for starting the application process and going through and becoming a member. It's long, but it's very much worth it. So we need people to help advance this mission, especially as we continue to scale. Now, we are a small volunteer-based organization. So we have one person that handles all of our interests as far as volunteers. And so it could take a little bit of time to get back to you, but we ultimately will get back to every single person.
So Derek, I'm sure that given that the kind of work you do, you've got some amazing stories. Are there any that you care to share at this time?
Yeah, there's a number of stories, that's for sure. But, you know, kind of talking about families reaching out to us, and you never know what little piece of information or a lot of information people might have. But not too long ago, this was prior to COVID, we were preparing for a mission to Papua New Guinea, and some family members reached out to us, and they were connected to a B-24 called Heaven Can Wait. And they said, you know, we don't know if you do work in Papua New Guinea or not, but we have this information related to the loss of our loved ones. And it just turns out that the families related to this B-24 have been in touch for decades, and they had a lot of really, really good information. And we were heading to that area of Papua New Guinea. And so we took that information with us, we executed the mission, and we located that B-24. It's kind of like one of those things, you never know what's the little piece of, or the little nugget of information that you might need to complete this case. And you know, could we have found that B-24 otherwise? Maybe. But it certainly helped us advance it and find it on this mission. And so they helped us with locating their loved ones. And, you know, then we ran into COVID, so things got slowed down for a little bit. But the United States Navy or the Department of Defense actually just executed last year a recovery effort on that site. And at that time, it was the deepest underwater recovery that they had done to date. It was down below 200 Wow. feet. And now that those family members are anxiously waiting for the identifications to take place so they can learn if their loved one has been recovered. But another neat piece of that was Scott Althos, who's a family member of Lieutenant Kelly associated with that site. You know, he was the person that was the point of contact that was reaching out to us and communicating with us. And he's a professor in communications at the University of Illinois in Champaign. And now he's a full-time member of the organization. So he's a Gold Star MIA family member. We were able to locate the site associated with his loved one. And now he's a member helping to advance our mission. And that's not a new thing. We have at least three members that we have located their loved one. Two of them have been repatriated, and now they're contributing in their own way. You know, this is a a very human mission. People connect to it, whether they have an MIA in their family or not. And these families are impacted by this across generations. And when somebody's repatriated, it has an incredible impact on the entire family, as well as the community around them, all the way up to the nation. Because, you know, we as Americans make a promise to these individuals that we'll do everything that we can to return them home should they fall in battle. And it doesn't have an expiration date. So when somebody is returned home, you know, that promise is kept and we restore some trust in our nation. And so because the impact this was created on these families, they appreciate it so much that they want to pay it forward. And so now people like Scott and others, Casey Doyle, Adam Gray, are former MIA family members, now Gold Star family members, that are contributing to the mission in their own way and helping provide answers to these other families. So every case is a special case. Every case is a special story. But that Heaven Can't Wait one is pretty cool.
Yeah. Derek, you mentioned earlier that some of those who you've found are declared to have been buried at sea and not brought back. How is that determination made as to whether the body is going to be returned to the United States for burial or whether it's going to stay put?
Yeah, well, in this case, it was sailors from the USS Abner Reed. Our team at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography found part of that ship that had 70 sailors on it up off of Alaska. And so it's assumed that that site will not be disturbed. It's not a recreational site. It's difficult to get to. It's cold, all the things. Now, if that site was, you know, in San Diego Harbor or something like that, where there's potential for it to be disturbed, then efforts will take place to recover the sailors from that or anybody associated with that. Most of the time we're finding, you know, aircraft, and, you know, right now they're relatively shallow. People can scuba dive these sites, but, you know, technology for recreational scuba is getting better, and things like that. So there is a chance that some of these buried at sea declarations could be changed if people encroach on a site. But if there's any potential for the site to be disturbed, then the Navy will typically recover the individuals from that and return them to their family. But if it's a sunk ship or something like that, and there's no chance or there's a limited chance that they'll be disturbed, they'll leave them where they lay. But ultimately that comes down to the United States Navy's decision, and it's outside of ours, our decision making. And but if they called on us to put forth any effort and on the recovery side, we would certainly answer.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to know about the organization or you personally?
Well, since this is very close to Memorial Day, I just want to acknowledge that again. You know, Memorial Day and Veterans Day and the military holidays are very, very special to us. But Memorial Day is a big one because these service members are lost, and we are doing everything that we can to provide answers, again, to those families that have provided the most. And so in many ways, Memorial Day is every day for us, but this is just a nice reminder that drives it home. And I just hope that these families know that we are always thinking about them. It just brings it closer to the front of our mind when it's close to Memorial Day. But there are people out there, there are fellow Americans out there and other people out there that are doing everything that we can to provide answers that they have waited far too long to receive.
This is fascinating, important, and of course, very worthwhile stuff that you are up to. Derek Abbey from Project Recover, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was my pleasure, John. Thank you for having me.
I am often put in mind of the famous quote by William Faulkner, "The past is never dead. It's not even past." And it's terrific to have an opportunity to speak to people like Derek who remind us of the truth of that statement. But until next time, thanks for listening to The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.